This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Thursday, August 19, 2021, and today will be better than yesterday. I'm Buster Olney from a family place in Adirondacks. Christina Buswell is producing as Taylor Schwenk works to challenge his over-under on 37 and a half drinks over 4 days of a bachelor party. Christina, tough days for the Red Sox, tough day for Red Sox fans. What's it been like for you?
It has not been easy. I can tell you that. My grandfather, who watches every single Red Sox game, is at a loss for words right now, but what can you do?
Yeah, the shocker is that it's just gone so quickly, right? It felt like okay, they have a 9-game lead. They lost a couple games. They'll hang on. Like, they're sinking so fast. That's what's crazy about it.
Exactly. It's like, how do you go so quickly into the opposite direction? I don't know. I hope we can figure it out. But you know, I'm not losing hope.
Tough night last night for the Red Sox at Yankee Stadium. We talked leading up the trade deadline about how Anthony Rizzo would have been an absolutely perfect addition for Boston. Well, both ends of that played out last night in the bottom of the second inning. The Yankees were ahead 2-1. Rizzo came to the plate and he hit a ball to first base to Dalbec, who, of course, is not as good as Rizzo defensively. Here's what happened.
Anthony Rizzo, who all throughout his career chokes up in those two strike at bats, ground ball, and it kicks away from Dalbec, and that's going to score two. Bobby Dalbec could not field it cleanly, and now it's 4-1 Yankees.
So at that point, the Yankees had a 4-1 lead. They took a lead into the ninth inning. Aroldis Chapman came in, and he struggled, gave up a home run. Another guy got a hit, there was a walk, and he was pulled from the game.
Line drive, right field, base hit. Judge up with the ball. Bogart stops at third. J.D. Martinez, though, keeps the game going, and he does get the tying run to home plate here in the ninth inning. Aaron Boone's coming out. And he is taking the ball. I was thinking maybe he was going to come out and check in with his great closer, but no. Chapman's out. The Red Sox have the tying run coming to the plate.
But the Yankees hung on to win 5-2 to continue their momentum. The Red Sox sliding in the other direction. The Tampa Bay Rays faced the Baltimore Orioles. And like all teams facing the Orioles these days, the Rays did a lot of damage.
Pitch to Franco. Here comes slice down the left field line, and that'll get in for a hit and another run. Around third, Lau, he'll score. Franco on his way to second. And Mateo's throw, not in time. RBI double wonder Franco, and the Rays have a 4-2 lead.
That from 620 WDA. The Rays win that game 8-4. And the biggest number coming out of this, the Orioles losing streak is now up to 14. The Brewers and the Cardinals. And with Milwaukee leading by a run, Christian Yelich surprised the Cardinals in the top of the 10th inning.
Reyes the pitch, and Yelich shows bunt, pushes toward third, charging to Sosa, gloves near the mound, throws on the move, safe is Yelich at first base. Coming in, Arias makes it 5-3 Brewers.
That from ESPN Radio, the Brewers win the game 6-4 in 10 innings. The Angels and the Tigers, Shohei Ohtani was excellent on the mound, 8 innings, and he also got this done at the plate.
That's in the bottom of the third. The pitch, and Ohtani swings, and he lifts a missile out into right center. That one is out of here. Home run, Shohei Ohtani. That is number 40 of the season. And how about tonight? On this Wednesday, it's showtime.
Home run number 40. That from Angels Radio, AM 830. The Angels win 3-1. The Mets needed some help desperately yesterday, and they got it from Kevin Pillar.
1-0 pitch. That's driven deep to left field. Going back his way, this time looking up. It's gone! A 3-run homer for Kevin Pillar. And the Mets suddenly on top here, 5-2 in the 12th inning.
So the Mets win 6-2. A lot of the headlines after the game were about how the Mets responded to a tweet from owner Steve Cohen. We'll be talking about that with Sarah Langs coming up. At the top of the National League East, the Braves and the Marlins. And Freddie Freeman had himself a day.
Well, he's had 3 hits tonight, and he's hooked all of them to right field. That's why they're playing him to pull. And he sends a drive to center. He may have done it again, Ben. Back goes De La Cruz. He leaps. It's gone! Home run! Cycle time for Freeman.
That from 680, the Fan. The Royals and the Astros. Hunter Dozier hit a two-run homer to give the Royals a lead in the bottom of the seventh.
Here's Taylor's pitch, and Dozier swings and hits one deep to left field. Back it goes and gone. He'll get Benintendi to third and home, and coming up right behind him with a two-run home run, and the Royals lead 3-2.
That from 610 KCSP, and the game ended in dramatic fashion.
1-1 pitch. Lined left field. This could tie the game. That's a hit. Benintendi's going to throw home. A one-hopper. Oh, hit the plate.
Final score there. Kansas City 3. The Astros 2. The White Sox beat Oakland 3-2. Lance Lynn was ejected weirdly. He was coming off the mound after the fourth inning. The umpire who was going to check him for sticky substances, according to Lance Lynn, was a little late getting over there. He wound up throwing his belt toward the umpire. He got ejected. Here was Lance Lynn after the game describing what happened.
I was coming off the mound. He was late getting over, so I left my glove and my hat. And then while I was going down the dugout trying to see the trainers because I'm dealing with something, he yells at me that he needs to see my belt. So I tossed it up, and then he throws me out. No, they don't care. He threw me out because I tossed my belt. And I said, well, if you're over here on time, we wouldn't have this problem. No, I mean, he's late getting over there. And then I'm trying to get some work done to go back out for the fifth. And, you know, obviously, I hurt his feelings.
So at the end of the day, the Yankees now lead for the number one wild card spot by a game over Oakland. They move past the Athletics. They're two ahead of Boston in the loss column. Seattle, 65-56, three games behind Boston for the second wild card. Oakland behind Oakland for the second wild card. And Toronto, which lost to Washington, and Oakland for the second wild card. For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
This is The Numbers Game with Sarah Langs.
Sarah Langs, reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, first off, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Buster. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me. I suspect that you were as amused by what happened to Lance Lynn as I was last night. You know, the great thing about Lance is that whenever he has these situations that happen on the field, he tells us exactly, because he doesn't know anything other than to be completely direct. Not only is a pitcher in the way that he attacks hitters, but also in the way that he talks about the sport. He's like, yep, here we go. This is, I was coming off the field and the umpire was late getting over to check me for foreign substances. And I threw my belt at him and he didn't like that. Third base umpire Nick Lentz, who had his first career ejection. I suspect, knowing Lance a little bit, that what was going on was that Lance was a little bit frustrated that he had to work so hard, 88 pitches through four innings. And it was a young umpire who felt his wrath. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's probably a lot of it. I mean, you know, given what happened, you see an ejection, you get a little bit concerned just seeing some ire and whatever else on the field. And, his post-game press conference definitely sort of quelled any of that. Just seeing his response to everything, I think he has a really good approach to the game, doesn't take himself too seriously. And it was kind of funny to hear what he was saying. And there's not a lot of ejections where the post-game press conference is really that funny when you hear what he's saying.
All right. Tony La Russa, I thought, had a good quote after the game. He said he threw the belt. As soon as he threw the belt, you can't make that gesture like that. That's when he was gone. The umpire banged him right away. I went out there to try to save it, but that's what got him ejected. My only point was, when he was out there, was that if you're not emotional in this game, you're not very good. And Lance in that moment was emotional. Big picture, they win again. They beat a good team in the Oakland Athletics. It does feel like, Sarah, that the White Sox are just coming together as we go down the stretch.
Oh my gosh. I mean, this is exactly what we thought might happen. I mean, even when Eloy Jimenez got hurt in spring training and when Luis Robert got hurt in the beginning of May, we thought, oh my gosh, if they play really well, they're going to be getting healthy at the exact right time, right there in August or in September. And that's what's going on. I mean, Eloy Jimenez has hit all of these home runs as he's come back. He's already just seamlessly back in that lineup and crushing the ball. And Robert has looked so good. I mean, I've really enjoyed seeing what he's done. It's only 32 games so far, but just seeing everything that he's done in terms of, you know, really becoming that five-tool player that we were expecting him to be last year. He showed flashes of it in 2020, but his average wasn't that high. He didn't really slug all that much, but his strikeout rate is way down this year. And I think that that's really helping. He's not swinging and missing very much. He's making a lot of end zone contact and he's just looking exactly like the hitter that he was in the minors and that we knew would be this hitter in the majors at some point.
And at the end of that win last night, their magic number to clinch the American League Central is down to 31. It's not often we're talking about magic numbers in the middle of August, but that's how good they've been. And I got to say, just because we've been lucky enough to have them on Sunday Night Baseball a couple times in the last month, that after I walked away from that, this sort of sluggish September, the way that we saw the Indians for a couple of years, you know, 2018, 2019, going down the stretch, because I feel like that, you know, unlike there's just something about the makeup of this White Sox team, that the fact that you have Lance Lynn at the front of your rotation, he's always going to pitch the same. The fact that you have Tim Anderson as a leadoff hitter, being aggressive the way that he always is. You've got Jose Abreu. I do feel like they've got like the perfect leadership to take a team into the postseason after having wrapped up a division in early September. What do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we're already seeing evidence of that because they've had this 10-game lead here for a while now, or right around that, you know, leading by 7+ games. It feels like pretty much the entire season and they haven't let up, you know, and when you get to that point as a team, when you're so good, you're in that sort of juggernaut category that you almost have to challenge yourself to continue to play hard. I think we've already seen that from them. And I completely agree with the leadership they have, personalities in that clubhouse, everything else. I don't see them taking any sort of, you know, break down the stretch or anything else. And I also think that they're so deep now with these guys coming back from injury that they also don't need to take a break, even just lineup wise or in terms of who's pitching in their bullpen. They have two closers and now they're both looking pretty good. There were some stumbles over the last few weeks with both Kimbrel and Hendricks, but Hendricks looked really good last night. And I just think that they have enough guys that they're not going to take part of September off or anything else like that.
Recently, Angels manager Joe Maddon was asked about the American League MVP award voting, and he said, not even close. Talking about the value that Shohei Ohtani brings to the Angels versus the value of other players. I don't think he mentioned specific players by name, but a Vladimir Guerrero Jr. with the Toronto Blue Jays. And we saw that last night. Ohtani was tremendous, 8 strong innings. He hits a home run. He's the first player in Major League Baseball to get to 40 homers. Can you quantify, you know, what his overall value is? Because I think the numbers probably reflect what Joe Maddon's talking about.
They totally do. So he has 4.6, if we look on Fangraphs, 4.6 wins above replacement as a hitter this year and 2.6 as a pitcher. So that's 7.2 total. And if we go to the leaderboards, look at everybody else who only does one thing or the other, the most WAR for any hitter who's just a hitter is Vlad at 5.3. And the most for any pitcher who's just a pitcher is 5.8 for Corbin Burns. So he is basically 2 wins above replacement ahead of anybody else. And certainly ahead of Vlad, you know, he's 1.9, basically we'll call it 2. And I think we've seen that on the field. I mean, he's really separated himself, but both of them went into a little bit of hitting slump sort of after the All-Star break. But I think Ohtani has managed to still hit these home runs. He's looking better lately. And Vlad is still a great player. He's having a slam dunk MVP season in literally any other year. I mean, we see these things happen and ultimately he's a great player who will have other seasons like this, but Ohtani is just head and shoulders above. And I was actually interested. I mean, Joe Maddon was asked post game, not just about the MVP, but about the Cy Young. And I think that's maybe a little bit premature at this point, but he is tied for the second best ERA since July 1st. I mean, he's become a really, really great pitcher for them, especially over this last month or so.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Teams, generally speaking, when they place a financial value on a player, I know it's been somewhere in the range of $8 to $9 million per year. So when we're talking about Ohtani, and we're in mid-August, again, to repeat, we're in mid-August. So according to those numbers, his value to the Angels would be something in the range of $56 to $60 million, right in that range.
That sounds about right. Yeah. I mean, it's just insane. And obviously we talked about contract talks and the decisions that they're going to have to make with him and with getting other pitchers and everything else over the next few years. And yeah, this season's going to make it really tough to put those zeros after those numbers.
All right. Tell me what you see in the Red Sox situation. They lose to the Yankees again. It's incredible how much ground they've given up in such a short period of time. Alex Cora said yesterday that Kyle Schwarber is going to play in the field some more going forward. At first base, sometimes he's going to be in the outfield. But as you and I talked about the trade deadline, Sarah, no matter what choice that Alex makes with Schwarber in the lineup, he's got to diminish his defense. If Schwarber plays first base, something he's never done professionally, that's going to hurt the Red Sox at first base. If he plays in the outfield, that's going to hurt them defensively because they're going to have to bench a better defender. It feels like he has a lot of imperfect choices at this point.
It really does. I mean, that entire, you know, conundrum with he and JD Martinez, you end up either way with someone who you don't necessarily want in the field, probably pretty consistently. And obviously Schwarber is a bat that I think they really need in there right now. I mean, it feels like their offense over the last few games, especially and during this stretch, has kind of turned into one of these, they score via the homer and that's pretty much it sort of offenses. And that's not, I mean, it's working for the San Francisco Giants, but generally that's not where you want to be if you're trying to be competing, you know, in this sort of realm. So I just think it's a really tough spot, but ultimately I just come back to the pitching. I mean, I know Chris Sale came back and I know that he looked really great, but generally this has been a lot of their pitchers sort of returning to the norm. I think some guys who probably overperformed in the first few months. So I just don't know how you necessarily remedy that, especially in this day and age without waiver claims, without the ability to really upgrade your roster at this point in the season. I mean, they got Chris Sale back. That's pretty much the only upgrade that you can do at this point.
So during this stretch that the Yankees are playing well and, you know, taking over last night, they took over the lead for the number one wild card spot in the American League. Everything's going well, but Luke Voit says out loud, you know what? I deserve to play as much as Anthony Rizzo, which is very interesting. Aaron Boone, the Yankees manager, wound up talking with him. It is going to be an issue going forward. And I know, while you know, Booney's someone we both know well, probably said all the right things to Luke Voit behind the scenes. Hey, get ready. Don't worry. I'll work in there. I think in the end, he's going to want to play Anthony Rizzo just about every day. How do you see this playing out?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see how it can't be Anthony Rizzo every day. I mean, I think that Yankees fans probably enjoyed hearing that from Voit, and I certainly commend the player for saying something like that. I mean, he did not play well for a lot of this year, but he also was hurt for a lot of time. And to basically lose his starting job because of this trade, I mean, I understand that there's a lot of emotion that comes with that, but he has played well, certainly in the time when Rizzo was on the COVID injured list. But I don't see how you make that trade for Rizzo and it's anybody other than him. I mean, maybe Voit can find a way to, you know, a couple off days here or there, or becoming a pinch hit specialist or something else. I'm just not really sure, but it doesn't really seem that he can be the starting first baseman going forward. But he had a good point. I led the majors in home runs last year. You know, I had a great year. You know, he made good points there, but unfortunately Rizzo has been great for the team. Not unfortunately, but unfortunately for him. And Voit has struggled at times this year.
Yeah. And I think also, when you look at, you know, the choices that Aaron Boone's going to make, yeah, he's going to rest Giancarlo Stanton, I think probably more down the stretch. load management for guys like Aaron Judge. But generally speaking, his choice as he moves forward, I think, is to whether or not play Luke Voit or Giancarlo Stanton as DH, except on those rare days when he's going to play Stanton in the outfield. And you know, and I know that the guy who's making $30 million a year is probably the guy who's going to be in the lineup.
For sure. Not to mention, I mean, it's Giancarlo Stanton. You've been taking the salary out of it. I mean, that's why I should have said DH before, but it feels like Stanton should be DHing for them pretty much every day. And I know that they've played him in the field a couple times, and that's an ongoing conversation. And as you were saying, certainly with guys getting days off, maybe he does get some days in the field there, but it just really doesn't feel like there's space for Voit on the team. I mean, I thought the team was very lucky that they hadn't traded Luke Voit at the trade deadline after they acquired Anthony Rizzo, because then when Rizzo got sick, they did need Voit. I mean, that's kind of how I had viewed that. I think everybody thought that it might make sense for them to explore a Voit trade if they had the time to, since that Rizzo trade wasn't on the actual trade deadline day. But, you know, I commend the player for wanting to play every day. I think that every fan wants to hear that, but I'm just not sure where there's room.
It's well established on this podcast that you are a Mets fan, so I had to ask you about this. Their owner, Steve Cohen, yesterday was busy on social media before the Mets game against the Giants, you know, riding a 5-game losing streak. Steve Cohen tweeted out, "It's hard to understand how professional hitters can be this unproductive. The best teams have a more disciplined approach. The slugging and OPS numbers don't lie." That was at 9:09 later in the day. The Mets win to break their losing streak. And I kind of cringed personally when I saw some of the stories of the Mets responded to their owner. I just don't think players think that way. I think they're kind of in a bubble. But that this tweet to me, above anything else we've seen from Steve Cohen so far, was an indication that, yes, he's going to be heavily involved. And that's not going to change. What'd you think of the tweet?
It certainly seems to indicate some heavy involvement. I mean, the thing that stood out to me most is that, you know, you talk about discipline, everything else. Their big trade deadline acquisition is one of the biggest free swingers in the game. And I know he's not playing right now. He's on the injured list, Javi Baez. But, you know, when you talk about disciplined approach, I mean, that's not necessarily what they were targeting at the deadline. So that was actually the first thing that jumped out to me, is that I'm not sure that that's exactly that's every team's goal, of course, but approach was not necessarily the thing that was in mind on July 30th, based on who they did end up acquiring. He's a great player, but everyone knows he swings a lot. But, you know, I mean, I think that there were a lot of people who, when it was clear that he was going to keep this Twitter account and own the team, were very interested at what sort of behind the scenes access this might provide or anything else. But I do think ultimately there's probably other ways to handle this, but we don't know. I don't know, at least, what went on behind the scenes. Was this after having a conversation with somebody or something else? It certainly started a lot of conversations early in the morning, especially early in the morning on the West Coast. And they did win the game. And I agree with you that I'm not sure there's really any connection there, but it did happen. And then when happened later.
So last night we were playing a family game of dictionary, and all of a sudden my son blurts out, "Freddie, cycle." He hit for a cycle. Freddie Freeman continues to roll. On May 7th, he was hitting 195. He since then is hitting a Major League Baseball best 337. His average, Sarah, over 300 to 302.
Yeah, I mean, he's looked so great. And, you know, we talk about the NL MVP race, and, you know, it seems like it'll be Fernando Tatis Jr., but also the Padres don't even necessarily seem like they'll make the playoffs at this point. And I do think that if they miss the playoffs, regardless of whether we should or should not wait those types of things, I think if the Braves win the division, there's a really strong case for him. I mean, I think it's either him or Austin Riley if you're looking for a guy to get MVP votes on this Braves team. But it's just great to see a guy who is a perennial all-star, perennial MVP candidate, get back to doing what he's doing. And I agree about the cycle. I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of the cycle. It's great to get four hits.
I didn't know that, Sarah. You're like Boog then.
I don't know if it's quite as strong as that, but I'd rather have four extra base hits. Like, why do we need the single in there? You know, I just think there's other ways to help your team even more, but it's great. we've had three of them this year. I just think that certain things lose their, it's just not as rare as people think, you know, but it's fun. It's very cool. He's done it twice. I didn't even remember that he'd done it the other time, which tells you how much I pay attention to the cycles, but it was great to see him get four hits and continue to help this team. I mean, the Braves now have a 3.5 game lead in the division. I mean, I was looking at stuff just after all games were over last night, and I was like, wow, that happened fast. I mean, the Phillies have obviously gone on a little bit of a slump since taking over the division. I think they're 2-6 since then. And the Mets, we know, had lost a ton of games until yesterday, but all of a sudden the Braves have a 3.5 game lead, which is probably what I would have told you they'd have around mid-August entering the season. So obviously it's been a very different journey to there, but they've gotten there. And of course, it's a huge credit to Freddie.
Yeah. Paul Imbecchini's our friend. You know, last month he was talking about how he, based on the Phillies' easy schedule, you know, he predicted the Phillies would win the division. The one part which I disagreed with him on that, and the reason why I felt good about my preseason pick of the Braves winning the division, was the Braves have a championship pedigree. Like, these guys have all been through this before. And on the other hand, that group of Phillies has not won together. Like, they don't have any experience with that, where you get the feeling down the stretch that once the Braves got within striking distance of the Mets, that guys like Freddie Freeman and Dansby Swanson and Ozzie Albies, even Austin Riley now, you know, he's been involved in multiple division titles. They would begin to sense the finish line. Charlie Morton at the front of their rotation. It just felt like at some point, if you kept the Braves in play long enough, that they were going to become more dangerous. Do you buy that?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it was cited as early as a month into the season. I mean, when they were below 500 right around May 1st, everyone was talking about how in 2019 it was kind of similar. And the difference was that in 2019, by the middle of the season, by the All-Star break, they had taken over the division. They didn't quite get there this year, but it's still, I mean, all season, it just felt like they were going to make that run. And even without Ronald Acuña Jr., I mean, I really like the acquisition of Jorge Soler, not to mention the fact they also got Jock Peterson, Eddie Rosario, who hasn't even played for them yet. I mean, they made so many acquisitions, basically four outfielders to replace one who was an all-star and MVP candidate. And I do agree that there is just something to the fact that that team has been there before, and that this group of guys together has been there before. And then you add someone like Charlie Morton, who has been there with another team or with other teams. It just felt like they were going to get there. And, you know, it feels like the Phillies lately, I mean, for the last 10 years at this point, there's just this hump that they can't quite get over. And it's amazing because they had so much momentum, and momentum isn't quantifiable, but they had it after that sweep of the Mets and getting into first place. And now they're losing to the Diamondbacks, you know, and I think there's a lot to be said for easy schedules down the stretch, not necessarily being the end all be all. I mean, the Padres just got swept by the Rockies. The Rockies are really good at home, but it's the Rockies. And then we have the Phillies losing to the Diamondbacks. I mean, I do think there's a theme there of some of these teams definitely still putting up a fight, even if they're way out of it.
All right. Last one. We got about a minute left. Eric Sorensen at Coach Sorensen 9. Asked, in your opinion, what's the Mariners going to have to do to get in the wild card spot? A lot of games with the Astros and the Athletics left. And then he has hashtag Bleacher Tweets. Since Godspeed to you, Taylor, we will need proof if you make the over, which is 37.5 drinks over the course of 4 days. Hashtag challenge accepted. Forget about Taylor and the over and under on all the alcohol he's going to consume this weekend. What do you see in the Mariners as we go down the stretch?
I mean, the Mariners have been fascinating all year. You know, we talk about run differential, and yes, their run differential is such a large negative number, in part because of some really bad early season losses. But everything that you look at with just the underlying stats of this team do not necessarily tell you it's a playoff team. And we haven't seen many teams make the playoffs with a negative run differential, and certainly not with as big of a negative number as they have. But, you know, the games against the Astros are going to matter. I mean, the Astros are another team that has kind of stumbled against these sub 500 teams. So if the Mariners can also play them as well as some of those other teams have, I don't see why they can't make up a little bit of ground there. But I just think that with how the Yankees have played lately and everything else, it just feels like it's becoming a little bit more of a pipe dream for the Mariners and for the Blue Jays. I mean, the Mariners have a great team. I loved watching J.P. Crawford play. I think that they have some really exciting players who I'm glad that I think have gotten a little bit more national notoriety this year. But ultimately, it just doesn't feel like a postseason team.
All right, Sarah. Great to talk with you. Thanks for doing this.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Thanks so much for having me, Buster.
Alan Gonzalez covers baseball for ESPN, and lately he's been covering the Trevor Bauer hearing. Alan, tell me what that's been like for you as a reporter.
Oh, it's been exhausting in ways that I had never really experienced, Buster. Just sitting in the courtroom the last 3 days. I'm going back there right now as we speak. I'm actually driving there for a fourth. It's grueling in the sense that, I mean, you see this woman who obtained a temporary restraining order against Trevor Bauer. She sat on that witness stand for what amounted to, with breaks and different days, more than 9 hours, Buster, just giving her testimony, going into detail about what happened during those two encounters and everything that she was dealing with after the fact, in between. She went into some of her personal history, including how long she had been sober and previous bouts with alcoholism and how that changed her perspective. And it's a lot. It's just very heavy subject matter. And then you see her get cross-examined by Sean Holly, who's a very experienced attorney who identified a lot of different holes in her story. And the subject matter alone is uncomfortable, and it's uncomfortable to talk about on camera. It's uncomfortable to depict in writing, but sitting there and having people go through it, watching her break down in several different instances for different situations, it's tough. It really is. This is one of the tougher assignments I've had.
What was the latest that you learned on Wednesday?
Well, Wednesday, the woman continued to be cross-examined by Bauer's team, and we also had two more witnesses called. One of them was her best friend. The other one was a forensic medical examiner. There was a lot on Wednesday. There was a lot on Monday and Tuesday as well. The big thing, and just to sort of summarize what we've been throughout these 3 days, Trevor Bauer's team has cross-examined her very aggressively on several things. One of them was a lot of text message exchanges that she left out of her declaration. They're text message exchanges that appear to show that she might have had, she showed an interest in wanting money out of this in some instances, or maybe she made light of some of her injuries, or maybe messages with Bauer in which she seemed to initiate wanting rough sex for that second encounter. But, you know, to be fair, those same text message exchanges, that some of which were left out of her declaration, they also show her being appalled at her injuries after that second encounter, which is why she ended up going to the emergency room in the first place. They brought in the forensic examiner, and the forensic examiner sort of downplayed the severity of her injuries. The woman talked about how what she observed in pictures, now keep in mind she is somebody who was retained by Bauer's legal team and was paid for them to provide her expert testimony. She was talking about the pictures that she saw weren't consistent with somebody necessarily being punched to the extent that she talked about in the declaration. But I should also say that that runs counter to the testimony provided by the nurse who actually physically gave her the SART exam the day that she went to the hospital. So I know it's a lot. In short, there's just been a lot of testimony. The woman has been very emotional throughout it. And one thing that she said this yesterday, actually, when one of Bauer's attorneys, Sean Hawley, was cross-examining her on missing text messages, she said that those text messages don't necessarily, they don't mean consent. And she keeps saying that even though she might have maybe pushed Trevor Bauer to have rough sex, she never consented to being struck and being scratched in the manner that she described.
What happens next?
Well, I can tell you what happens today, and that is that Trevor Bauer is going to be called to testify. He will not do so. He is going to plead the Fifth Amendment on every question, no matter how many questions they ask. It's according to what their attorneys once again told the judge yesterday. And after that, it's closing statements, and the judge will have a ruling is what I anticipate. So this matter will be wrapped up, but as you know, Buster, there are other issues at hand here. The reason why Trevor Bauer is not going to answer questions is because there is an ongoing criminal investigation with the Pasadena Police Department. And in addition to that, obviously, Major League Baseball is running its own investigation. So the first thing is this hearing, and the judge will simply determine whether or not the temporary restraining order that was obtained against him, whether it will be tossed out or whether it'll become permanent, which in California can last up to 5 years. But I've said this before, the specifics of this hearing, which is whether or not that restraining order will be in place, that's, and this is my opinion here, but this doesn't seem to be the most important issue for Trevor Bauer, because based on his dialogue with the woman, they hadn't even been in contact for a matter of about 4 weeks when she obtained the restraining order. So it's not necessarily what the judge rules with regards to that. This hearing, Buster, was always about what the evidence presented would be and how that could help Trevor Bauer either make up ground with regards to public perception about what actually took place, because this was his first time to offer his side of the story, and also what Major League Baseball will ultimately decide here. Because as you know, Major League Baseball doesn't need an indictment or an arrest or criminal charges in order to suspend a player. So a lot of this hearing could determine what his suspension looks like, even if charges ultimately are dropped, and we have no idea if that's going to be.
Yeah, I was going to say also, just from a pure practical standpoint, the question of whether or not he is charged criminally is going to be more pertinent to what Major League Baseball's decision is going to be ultimately. It does feel like they're just plowing in the wake. Like, you know, they're letting the criminal prosecution go on, and they will learn a lot through that process. Yes?
Absolutely. They need to get this right. And they definitely need to get this right. And so they're going to wait as long as possible. And look, the union has to sign off every time they extend administrative leave. The union has no problem doing so because the player is still getting paid. And the last thing the union wants is for the league to issue punishment before having all the information. And the last thing the league wants is to issue punishment, and then more information comes out later that would change it one way or the other. But I don't know when that's going to wrap up. That criminal investigation, Buster, has been ongoing since May 18th. Okay. We have now moved beyond 3 months of that criminal investigation. There have been no charges made. There have been no arrests made. And I got a sense that they were close to determining whether or not this would be passed off to the district attorney's office about a week or two ago. And we're not there yet. Maybe once this hearing concludes, which will be today, maybe that is what will kickstart everything else to follow thereafter.
And what's the Dodgers' response to all this, publicly or privately?
Well, the Dodgers have since the beginning, they've quietly sort of distanced themselves from Trevor Bauer. The first hint we had of that was when they canceled his bobblehead night, when they removed his merchandise from the team stores. But we never really heard from them for a while, at least when this initially went down. And Stan Kasten, their president, sent a memo to team employees on Monday afternoon, which we were able to obtain. In that memo, he talked about how the Dodgers just have no they have no patience for domestic violence. They don't stand for it, and he sort of admonished that altogether. He also explained why the team hadn't commented publicly on it, and he talked about why he wanted Major League Baseball's investigation to play out, the criminal investigation to play out. He also claimed that the team had no knowledge of a prior temporary restraining order that was obtained by a woman in Ohio in July of 2020. Obviously, that occurred before the Dodgers signed him. And when the Dodgers signed him, when they introduced him in the press conference, they talked about, actually, they raved about just sort of the background work that they did on him, and basically told fans, like, look, you're gonna have to trust us, because there was a lot of questions about Trevor Bauer and his online behavior at the time. And he claimed in that memo to employees that they didn't know about that restraining order about the woman in Ohio, which she eventually pulled back and has been sealed from court records. So that was the first we sort of heard from the team. That was the first we had heard from the team in a while. I suspect that once Major League Baseball rules, we're going to hear some really stern comments from them at that point. But they're waiting on Major League Baseball.
Last one for you. We got about a minute left. I want you to take your reporter's hat off and put on your columnist hat, so to speak, and just get your opinion about how it does feel like within the baseball community that there's a shift and that there's much less tolerance for players who are linked to this. We don't know what's going to happen in Trevor Bauer's case. But generally speaking, the sport seems to be distancing itself from players in these situations. What do you think?
Yeah, Buster, I've heard you talk in recent days about Roberto Osuna. And I think that is a very instructive example, a 26-year-old pitcher who could be a highly paid closer on a good team if it weren't for the domestic violence allegations that were made against him. It's not just that. It's what we've had this year. With Jared Porter, with Mickey Callaway, this coming on the heels of that. And it's why it's important within Major League Baseball's domestic violence policy that they're allowed to use nuance when it comes to punishing players for these types of things. They don't need criminal charges, because criminal charges, you need indisputable proof. You need proof beyond the reasonable doubt to hand down criminal charges. That's a high bar to clear. Major League Baseball doesn't need that. And I don't know what they're going to do here, but I do know that the reason why they're waiting so long is because they want to make sure that they get this right. And they do need to I don't want to go so far as to say set an example, but they need to make it clear to their fans that this is just not the type of thing that they're going to be able to tolerate, especially when you have a woman making such strong allegations against your highest paid player about the things that she says that he did to her. Obviously, there are two sides to every story, and you got to get all the information that you can. But I got to think, just given what's out there, Trevor Bauer had a really tough hill to climb going into this. And I'm not sure if he's cleared that bar yet.
All right, Alden. Nice work in the reporting, and hang in there.
Thank you, Buster.
Bleacher Tweets.
All right, here are the Bleacher Tweets. The first from D. He has hashtag MBFree, referring to Freddie Freeman, is now hitting 302. And if he keeps this up, he has to be in the running for MVP. I would agree with that. Now, I do think Fernando Tatis Jr. is still the guy who is the player to beat in the race for the National League MVP. Joshua Imhoff at JD9860 says, let's assume Shohei Ohtani is a 50-plus home run hitter along with 15 wins, 2 or 3 something ERA as a pitcher for the next 5 years. How do you calculate a salary to properly compensate that kind of value? Is 5 years, $250 million unreasonable? Joshua, I actually wrote a piece about that 2 weeks ago. That was exactly the number that I had one evaluator put on it. $50 million a year for 5 years. Otani's going to be a free agent at age 29, and he is going to have a lot of options, and he's going to make a lot of money. A lot of people wondered why, you know, he, in their eyes, sold himself short financially when he signed over here. He's going to wind up doing okay. If the Yankees, the Bill Chuck files at Billy Ball writes, if the Yankees and Braves make the postseason, Brian Cashman, Alex Anthopoulos, GMs of the year, anybody close? Look, I think so. In the American League, every year, you know, because the Rays challenges, Eric Neander always is in position when they win. You think about it, during the offseason, Charlie Morton walked away as a free agent. They traded Blake Snell, and then during the course of the year, Tyler Glasnow blew out his elbow. And yet the Rays have found a way again, it looks like, to win the American League East. They're certainly having a big lead. And the White Sox, at this point, look like to be the most dangerous team in the American League. Rick Hahn's done a great job ushering that team through the, you know, the rebuild period that they went through. You know, in the National League, I would suspect that Farhan Zaidi, because the Giants have the best record in baseball at this point, he probably would be the front runner for GM of the year. But look, Alex Anthopoulos' work leading up the trade deadline, I think, is going to turn out to be difference-making. Donald Gantz says, clearly, Uncle Steve is upset with the Mets' production. If you had to bet the family farm in the Adirondack vacation home. I want to make clear that I don't actually own this place. We rent it for my cousin Lucy. What do you think his moves and priorities are this offseason? I do think there's going to be a change in the front office there. I don't know exactly what the specifics of that are going to be, but given the level of expectation, given how many days the Mets were in first place in the National League East, I got to believe that there's going to be a big reaction from the owner, especially an owner who's showing to be as active as Steve Cohen is. That's it for today. My thanks to Sarah, to Alden, to Christina. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something that we need to fight against every single day.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.